Okay, so I'm glad you guys all are back safely. I hope you had a nice holiday. So we are sliding into the end game now, and presentations are scheduled. So this is what I think is supposed to happen. Next class, we have EM and Chem Medicine, then Superconductivity. And then December 9th, Accelerators and Detectors, and EM and Music. And then the last day of class, Rails on Velocity Beam Laser. Count on about 20 minutes, even on the days where there are only two groups, because depending on what I hear from you here, I may be trying to do a little bit more on those days too. So any questions, worries, issues about presentations? Okay, I'm glad to see that nobody just looked at me like, yeah.
Better to go over in time or under in time?
Would be better to go over in time or under in time? That sort of depends on better for who.
If you go way over in time, I'm just going to cut you off. So that's probably not good. If you go way under in time, you're probably not covering or doing enough with it that you probably have the opportunity to do. But I'll leave that to the class collectively to sort of decide. If it's spectacular in 15 minutes, then I'm not going to say anything bad about that. So 20 minutes is a target, but if you start to go over 30, including questions, so you know somewhere around 25, I'm going to start looking at anything. I'll bring a bouncer. Okay? So now I actually have a couple questions for you to figure out. I mean, some of this I think I'm pretty sure I know what you have not had, but not all of it. So I know most of you had high school physics, so you've probably seen a lot of this stuff, at least at some level. Geometric optics, I assume you've not seen in the 140 sequence yet, right? Okay. Have you seen interference and diffraction? Okay. Does this look familiar? Do you have any idea what this is? If you don't, raise your hand. I need an idea of what level of the class does. Okay. All right. So I'm going to definitely do geometric optics, and then I'm going to, depending on how much time we have, I'm going to do pieces of this. So some of you will have seen some of this and some of you won't, but I think it's important stuff. So I may run out of time, and if I do, okay, I run out of time. All right. Now, I also want to apologize a little bit, particularly in, well, actually for much of this stuff, the drawings can be a bit of a pain, and at least in geometric optics, the subject in and of itself is really not technically hard compared to a lot of the stuff that you're used to. So I'm going to take advantage of some slides I've already got. Some of that is because I bring in a lot of figures that are very clear. If I start doing hand drawings of some ray diagrams and everything, just trust me, you don't want me to do that. You'll look at that later and go, what is he drawing? So it's probably not a good thing. At any rate, so that said, I'm going to take advantage of old slides, partly because it allows me to go a bit faster, partly because it's neater, and I'll just try to post everything as we go. All right, so a lot of the fun with optics, or perhaps all of the fun with optics, comes from the fact that the velocity of light in the material is different from the velocity of light in the vacuum. And so you already know the fact that the velocity of light in a material should go as this, because in the material, epsilon naught becomes epsilon and mu naught becomes mu. Okay? And this number is different from this number, and it's in fact smaller than the speed of light. So we quantify that by saying that the speed of light over the vacuum is equal to the index of refraction. You probably don't have this glitch. I have been known to have more glitches than most people, but whenever I think of the index of refraction and I think of this ratio, I can never remember whether it's B over C or C over B. And the way to remember it is the index of refraction is always greater than 1, and C, the speed of light in vacuum, is always greater than it is in material, so you know it's C over B. C is equal to lambda nu, and V is equal to lambda in the material times nu, nu, not lambda. C over V is equal to lambda in a vacuum over lambda in the material, or you get that lambda in the material times n is equal to lambda in the vacuum. So clearly, if the velocity is changing, something has to change, and it's the wavelength that changes, not the frequency. The frequency characterizes the color of the light, if you will, but the wavelength will change. So here's a plot for different materials, and part of the richness of optics is the fact that different materials have different characteristics, which you can imagine because you have different epsilons and mu's. Certainly always for this class, you can assume that the index of refraction is uniform in terms of its orientation or whatever in the material. In the real world, you can have materials where the index of refraction has directionality in a material. So, for example, light with one polarization may traverse the material with a different velocity than light with another polarization. And that can lead to really wonderful and fascinating effects. It also makes some parts of your first year in graduate school an enormous pain in the butt, because to treat that, you have to use tensors and everything. So we talk about material going through, light going through materials. In the real world, it gets a bit more complex. But you can go a long ways by just assuming that it's a uniform index of refraction, and that, so it does vary from material to material. For glass, it tends to be around 1.5, 1.7. For water, about 1.3. For air, typically, it's a good approximation to assume it's just 1. But if you are asked a question that is needing some difference between vacuum and air, such as how does light bend as it hits the atmosphere or something if it's been going through a vacuum, then you need to take into account the fact that the air actually does have an index of refraction. And that index of refraction varies with the temperature and where you are in the atmosphere. So again, it leads to lots of fun. Actually, enormous pain for poor astronomers, but gotta make life interesting or they don't have a job. So one of the other really fabulous things about light and index of refraction, it's also one of the most enormous pains, depending on what you're trying to do with it, is that the index of refraction is frequency dependent or wavelength dependent. And we call that phenomenon dispersion. And you'll find that this leads to lots of problems in optics, but it also leads to a lot of richness in optics. So if the speed of light depends on the material, you can get to some pretty interesting stuff. I'm not going to derive this, but it's quite doable. If you imagine that we have a plane electromagnetic wave, so imagine these lines represent the peak of the electric field in some sinusoidally varying plane wave that's propagating in the direction of the blue arrow, okay? And it hits a piece of glass. Here you have one index of refraction, here you have another index of refraction. when it hits the piece of glass, if you think about what's going to happen, at this point, for example, if you think about what happens with the light that propagates from this point over the next moment, this direction it travels more slowly than it does that direction. So this part of the wavefront is going to move further this way than the wavefront is going to go down that way. And if you just sort of draw little wavelets and think about how that has to happen, what you'll find is that the plane of propagation basically has to have a bend right here because the velocity of the light here is less. We could look at how the electric field and the magnetic field behave at the boundary, and we can derive boundary conditions for the continuity of the electric field or the magnetic field in terms of its perpendicular component and its parallel component, yeah, outside material and inside material. So one can go through that and basically derive this fact, okay? And you'll do that in 217. It's very cool. You guys are quite capable of it, but I'm not going to do it now because I'm going to do some other stuff. But it's very neat stuff. Anyway, so and it's not really that hard to do. So one can extract this very fact, and when you do, you can actually extract this to be quantitative. And so all of you probably heard of and use Snell's law. So what you find is that there is, if you have light incident at some angle, and when you say it's incident at some angle, conventionally we are talking about the angle with respect to the normal to the surface that's between the two interfaces. So I have one material with index refraction 1, one material with index of refraction 2. Here is the surface. We always assume it's flat, flat. We don't worry about surface roughness unless you're in the real world and having to deal with it. So we call the incident angle to be the ray of light that's coming in. You think of it as a ray. If we're extracting Snell's law, then it's good to think of these plane waves so that you can look at continuity and everything here. But once you've figured it out, then we sort of go into what I would call the ray mode of thinking about light, where you think of this as a little laser beam or whatever coming in. And it comes in at an angle that is theta incident with respect to the normal to the interface. And the light can be reflected. And if it is, then there is an angle of reflection. And if you derive the relationship between these two angles, you'll find that they're equal. Okay, that is something that comes out of basically the boundary conditions and Maxwell's plane wave analysis that I just mentioned. Light can enter into the other medium, and if it does, as we looked at a moment ago, it can be bent. And if it is, we call that ray that goes in the refractive ray. And it enters the material at an angle, which we call the refractive angle, and that is the angle with respect to the normal here. Okay. If N1 is bigger than N2 is bigger than N1, so this would be equivalent to light entering from air to water or from air to glass, then this bending is toward the normal. So you'll note that theta refracted is less than theta incident, so it is bent toward the normal. If you're going from a high index of refraction to a lower index of refraction, so water to air, glass to air, something like that, so N2 is less than N1, then this bend is away from the normal. Okay? So we quantify it with Snell's law, which is N1 times sine theta 1 is equal to N2 times sine theta 2, where this would be the incident angle and index, and this would be the material that you're entering into. All right? Yes?
I'm just wondering if you have a situation where you have like a huge index of refraction and like some fixed angle, and it was enough that like when you divide N1 over N2 times sine theta 1, it's greater than one, so you can't.
Just hold that thought. We're coming there. Thank you.
Okay, so what you'll find if you're coming from a region of a large index of refraction, one that's small, so N1 is greater than N2, you can have the situation that you just described, which is what will happen is as you increase this angle, because this one goes down, you'll eventually come to the point where this angle, that is the refracted angle, is 90 degrees. Okay? And so in that case, we call the angle the critical angle. And what that means is that as you go up to, until you reach that angle, you have light that actually penetrates into this other medium. At that angle, the light basically goes along the interface, and it doesn't really penetrate the medium. It sort of just skirts it. And then if you go bigger, then you have total internal reflection. And this leads to all sorts of interesting things, like if there's a fish in the water in a pond or something, if he's far enough out from you, you can't see him at all, because all the light from the fish is internally reflected. So you get a lot of new things. Optical fibers can take advantage of total internal reflection. So this is one of the ways in which you transmit the light, because it won't penetrate out if its angle is large enough. Okay. So there's a lot of physics here. And we call this, it's important to understand the criteria for critical angle. You can use that in lots of things. You okay with that?
Yeah.
At the critical angle, what?
Would you not have any reflected?
I don't know. At the critical angle, it just basically goes right along the surface. I don't know whether you call that reflected or refracted, or it's at the boundary.
Yeah, but would you not also get a reflected one at the critical angle, which isn't the same?
I don't know whether we call the ray that comes out after it hits the boundary at a critical angle, whether we call that reflected or refracted.
Well, yeah, no. I'm saying, wouldn't you get another ray that's reflected from the surface?
No? I don't understand what you're saying.
Because the dark one is reflected, right? And then
this one is totally reflected.
Right. And then some rays, when you hit a surface, are reflected and refracted.
Oh. Yes. Okay. Sorry. Yes. This ray might have a reflected component, is what you're saying. Yes, that can happen.
And the one at the critical angle?
At the critical angle, no. It just, this is sort of everything goes like so. And at this angle, it's totally reflected. Yeah.
So, how come when you bounce something off of a certain angle, shouldn't light traveling then be refracted, just travel at a 90-degree angle so along the surface of the material?
Yeah, I think it does.
Because don't you conserve the amount of light the system that must usually use?
Say that last part again, don't you?
Doesn't it usually use so that no light escapes the system? So wouldn't that imply that it's all reflected?
Well, like I say, I think that critical ray at 90 degrees, do you call that all reflected or sort of all refracted? It's sort of on the boundary. I don't know how to.
Okay.
I don't even know. If we think of it as a limiting angle, maybe it's not even fair to think of it as having the reality of a ray that goes right along the surface, because you're either going to be reflected or refracted at an angle very close to 90 degrees, right? So it's the actual critical angle, I guess you could say, is infinitesimally small. So maybe that's the way to think of it. In practice, you guys are jumping into the deep end. It's really, in practice, you don't need to worry about that.
That's not to say it's not cool, but good questions, but you don't usually, it's basically a threshold angle that you use to answer everything.
On the critical angle, is it traveling at the speed that it was in the medium it was going into, or the medium that it was
on the critical angle?
Yeah.
There is no wave traveling at critical angle. You either have it sort of in the other medium or this medium, but it's more or less close to 90 degrees. That's how I would address that, I think. I don't know if it's fair to talk about a wave that's sort of in and sort of out. That's sort of two different waves, I think, under that point. Probably you can even do that quantitatively, but I don't think I've ever done it. Okay, so the fact that you have dispersion and the fact that you have Snell's law leads to a lot of fun. If you have an air-glass interface, for example, and we use Snell's law, which tells us that the light is bent toward the normal, if you look at the dispersion of typical glasses, then as we go to blue, the index of refraction is a little bit bigger than the red. Means the blue is bent just a little bit more. And so if we have white light incident on an interface like this at some angle, then the red will not be bent as much as the blue, and you can separate white light. So this is basically the principle behind using prisms to spectrum analyze light. It's also the fact that you can bend the light is fabulous, because you can take light of a form like this, and we'll talk about these in a moment, but basically the first interface you get bent toward the normal, the second interface you get bent toward the normal. So what happens in practice is a ray up here gets bent toward the normal, toward the center line of this lens, and a ray down here gets bent the other way, and so you can have convergence of the light. So lenses operate because of this. So a lot of richness in this. So if you have a lens with a different shape, you have the same thing that happens, but the rays diverge. Because of dispersion, the degree of bending is frequency dependent or wavelength dependent, which means the blue light will converge at a point earlier than the red light. So this is something that affects your optics. If you're trying to build some, use a lens to bend light, to image basic white light or something, this is a limiting factor in your ability to do things. So a lot of what you need to do if you are going to be in the real world and do serious optics, you have to use special lenses and everything to try to correct for this kind of thing. This would be known as a chromatic aberration of the lens, because it will actually lead to, if we tried to make a picture of something, what you would find is that the position of focus would be frequency dependent, and this will lead to a smearing in your picture. So it's a limitation to accuracy with which you can image things. If you're into optical fibers, then chromatic dispersion is one of the limiting factors on your ability to send pulses long distances. So if you can stretch back to probably 143 or some sort of Fourier analysis if you've had it, you can describe a wave which has a variation in time as an infinite sum of harmonic functions. Let me rephrase this. I can take any pulse in space, and I can describe it as an infinite series of waves, harmonic waves, in time. And this is what Fourier analysis is about. So this allows us to take any shape pulse
and to describe it in terms of harmonic waves. That's why when we talk about waves, we don't worry about whether you have pulses or not. We just do harmonic stuff, because in the end, you can describe anything you want with sum of harmonics. So that's the whole thing behind Fourier analysis. Now, one of the things you'll find if you go into that is that in order to describe a sharper and sharper pulse, you have to, the terms that have the higher frequencies, which have the shorter wavelengths, become more important. And it should make sense, because shorter wavelength is needed to describe something if it's narrower. All right? So what that means is, if I want to communicate using optical fibers, what I'd really like to do is to have very short pulses or non-pulses, and you can think of it as Morse code, right? Dot, dot, dot. It's probably more complicated than that, but you know, you have bits. They're on or they're off, and they're on if you've got a pulse, and they're off if they're not, and from that you can encode it, all your information. So if you want to send more and more information, you would like to have shorter and shorter pulses. The way you do that is, in order to have that, it requires a larger frequency range. If you have a larger frequency range, the different frequencies travel at different speeds, and that naturally broadens out the pulse. So there's an inherent limit to what you can do. And if you're really into optical fibers, ways to try to overcome that involve a lot of the things that you can do. So for example, one of the things they do is they choose an optical fiber in a specific frequency where you also have to worry about absorption. There is a little bit of absorption in the glass. So they choose a frequency where the absorption is fairly minimal, and then they design the optical fiber so that only a very narrow range of frequency around that particular frequency goes. Well, these are called single mode optical fibers. So that can help. Multi-mode, well, anyway. So there's a lot of fun with that. And it does get heavily involved in the reality that glass has dispersion and everything, if you ever want to get into it. Okay, so I want to talk a bit about lenses and geometric optics. So we have convex and, So we have lenses that are thicker in the middle, are called convex lenses. And by virtue of being thicker in the middle, you'll have light that's out here bent toward the center line, and light over here bent toward the center line. So the light is going to converge. Okay? And in general, you can use graphics to figure out what's happening or picture it by looking at rays of light emanating from a single point on some object. You can think of the light coming from a point, say, on the tip of that arrow, coming out in spherical wave fronts. Whenever you're doing optics, you can sort of think every point is a source of a spherical wavefront of light. So if you want to understand how light from different points interfere with each other, you can think of a spherical wavefront here and a spherical wavefront here and look at how they combine. Okay, so that's how you do diffraction, for example, or some form of interference. If you want to do ray tracing to understand geometric optics, you can think of this as being a point of a spherical wave of light. And then let's just follow three particular rays of light, because quantitatively what happens with these particular choices of rays are things you can know easily. So, for example, there's a ray of light that goes through that happens to hit this interface and that interface both at 90 degrees, even though it doesn't really look like that in this particular drawing. That ray of light will go straight through the glass without being bent, because its angle of incidence is zero. Okay? Then you have a ray of light that's comes in straight parallel to the axis of symmetry of the lens itself. We say that ray is coming in from infinity, because if this point were infinitely far away, all the rays of light would be coming straight at the lens. So if we say it comes from infinity, you think of it as coming in straight
The lens, depending on its power, we say it has a certain focal length. This ray of light will be bent so that it crosses the center line of the lens at the focal length of the lens. That's sort of how you define what you mean by focal. That characterizes the lens, the power of the lens. If it's a more powerful lens, then it bends the light more and the focal length is shorter. A third ray that goes through the focal length on the other side, and there's a symmetry here, is bent such that it goes off to infinity. That is parallel to the line that goes through the center of the lens. These three lines, you can do it graphically, just know analytically, they'll meet at a point over here. And that's the point where we say you get an image of that point of the object is projected here. So we call that the image distance. This distance would be the object distance. Okay? If the middle of the lens is thinner than the lens on the outer part, then it's a diverging lens because it causes the rays that pass through it to move away from each other. These are known as concave lenses. You may wonder how to keep concave and convex straight in your mind, because if you're like me, you have a glitch. I never know which is which. Here's how I remember it. Concave, got a little cave right here. Okay? That's how I do it. If people only knew how complex physics really was. The string theorists are saying, oh yeah, there's a little cave there. All right. So in this case, again, we have a focal length for the lens. And the way to think about it is that rays coming in from infinity, that is, they're all parallel to this line that of symmetry for the lens, are bent in such a way that if you were to project their path back, they would pass through the focal point of the lens. Again, if the lens has a much stronger focal length, then these rays are bent more, and this focal length is going to be shorter. It's a more powerful lens. So you can determine where the image is formed by doing this ray tracing game, and you can even do it with a diverging lens. And you may think that's a little bit strange, because how can you have an image for a diverging lens where the rays all come apart? And you can. It is counterintuitive in one way. If you have a converging lens, so I have something over here, and the light passes through the lens. Oh, shoot. There it is. Here, it's real light. It passes through the lens. I can actually place a piece of paper here, and it will image this thing over here. So it's easy to visualize what you mean when you talk about image. When we have something, a diverging lens, for example, because the light rays diverge, if we define image as sort of the point from which the rays appear to emanate, if we're over here, the image turns out to be behind the lens. Now, I can't place a piece of paper here, because then nothing comes through the lens, right? So you can't think of it quite that way. The way to think about it is, here are the real rays of light. This thing bends the light such that when it enters your eye, it looks as if they are coming from that point. So that means your eye, if it's over here, is going to see this instead of that. Okay? If you can place a piece of paper there, we call it a real image. If you can't, We call it a virtual image. All right? But the reality is the light rays that are over here are coming as if they came from this point. So if I have a multiple lens system, a lens here would think of this as being its object, not that. Right? For a lens over here, it's dealing with rays as if they came from this thing. Okay, so even a virtual image can be a real object for some other lens. In fact, you have to think of it that way. And you have to think of it that way if you're going to do multiple lens systems. Okay with that? So, the power of lenses is measured in diopters. So, as I said, the focal length, if it's shorter, means the lens is bending the light more one way or the other. And so this number becomes shorter. But the power becomes larger as this number becomes smaller. It's positive if it's converging. It is negative if it's diverging. And for MKS, we put it in meters. That's defined as in diopters, by the way. Okay. So lenses of different power have a different ability to magnify things. We define magnification. What you mean by magnification is sort of, if I have an object, what is the size of the apparent size of the image relative to the size of the object? So if you make such a ray diagram like this, this object has a certain height, and depending on the power of this lens, you'll have a certain height over here. And the ratio of those heights would be what we define. The ratio of this one to that one would be what we define as magnification. Because this is simple triangles, the geometry is such that the distances also give you that. The minus sign is coming in because of conventions that we'll talk about. You can have a diverging lens, it also can have magnification. Yeah.
Maybe just like a stupid question, but like if you have a magnifying glass and the sun is your light source, and you focus it to a point on the ground, H0 would be like the radius of the sun, and HI would be the radius of that little dot you just put on the ground. Wouldn't that be like an unimaginably high magnification?
Yeah, it ends up you don't really think of it that way because for something that's that far away, all the rays are coming straight in effectively, so they just get focused at the focal point. So in fact, when you talk about magnification in that way, you actually use the angle and not so much the height. I mean, you do get an intense thought. I mean, you are limited by primarily by diffraction, actually, which we can talk more about or you've seen, but the way to think about that is that light coming from here acts like an independent light source from light coming from here. So if you think about it as a wave, you'll get basically interference between these different sources, and that will limit your ability to image things over here. That is the limiting thing for the intensity and the imaging ability for optical systems. So what will happen is I have a point source of light, which you could imagine the sun, I think if the sun was up, it will be imaged with some width down here because your inability to fully get that image. But Okay, so a lot of what we're doing is just sort of looking at these rays, but in fact you can do this stuff quite quantitatively by using the so-called thin lens equation. If these lenses are pretty thin and the optics is good, this is a reasonable treatment. If the lenses are sort of thick, so that would be the lens is thick compared to the dimensions that you have in the problem, then this equation is no good for you anymore. So if you ever do real optics, you need to worry about those kinds of things. But of course, if you're doing real optics, you'll have other aberrations you'll have to think about too. But this is really good for a rule of thumb. So it says 1 over the distance to the from the optic over 1 over the distance to the image is equal to 1 over the focal length. It's pretty trivial. The hard part is that each of these things comes in with an algebraic sign we have to keep straight. So, for example, the focal length is positive if it's a converging lens and negative if it's a diverging lens. Typically, if you have an optic on this side of the lens, then the optic distance is positive. If you have the image on this side of the lens, the image distance is positive. If, as you've seen, you can sometimes have images over here, then you would consider that image distance negative. Okay, so there's a bunch of conventions you'll have to get used to using when you do some of these. It's easy to do, but you really do have to do your homework problems to sort of get it down. I think I used here the conventions in Gene Foley. I didn't actually check to see what they are. And they're either the same or they're not, and I don't know which. But basically, you need to pick a convention and use it. So I'm not going to really read through these. Real images, the ray passes through the image. Virtual images, they don't. Positive focal length for converging, negative for diverging. The optic distance is positive if on the side of the lens from which the light is coming, and negative if it's on the other side. You may think, how in the world can an object be on the other side of the lens? Okay. If I have a lens here that forms an image out here, and now I put another lens here, the rays of light that enter this lens look like they're sort of coming from this thing. So you would have an object that's actually on the other side of the lens in a two-lens system. And that would be an instance where the object distance for that second lens, when you're calculating what happens with it, has to come in negative. So it can get a little bit tricky. I don't think it's useful for me to just read through this. You basically will do some homework problems where you'll have to figure out the conventions and get used to it. Okay?
Most of this becomes important when you're dealing with multiple lens systems. For a single lens, it's usually pretty trivial. Okay, so lenses are important to us. I won't waste a lot of time with this. Some of these slides are prepared for like physics 114 where I try to convince them that physics has something to do with the real world now and then. You have a lens in your eyes, and if you are nearsighted, what it means is that your lens is too strong and the light converges in front of the area where you can image it, where your body images it. So in order to fix that, you put a lens in that diverges a little bit so that the light converges at the right place. So if you look at people who have glasses that are very thick on the ends and thin in the middle, they are nearsighted. If somebody's farsighted, okay, so that means an object, they see better things that are far away. What's happening is their lens is too weak, and you need to have a thicker lens. And so people that are farsighted have like the Coke bottle lenses. You have a lens in here, which is very important, and as you get to your mid-40s, you will find that your eye's ability to... What will happen is if you're trying to focus on something that's closer and closer,
this piece of your eye doesn't change. It has curvature. You have the cornea of your eye, and there is curvature in there, and the cornea has a certain thickness, so optics happens. But what's really changing in your eye is you have this lens that gets deformed. You can change the focal length of this lens depending on what you're looking for. That's what you mean when you talk about your eyes focusing. One of the things you'll find as you reach about the mid-40s, you can always, if you ever wonder about somebody's age, there's certain things that as you get older you realize you know exactly how old they are when you see it. If you see somebody pull out reading glasses, they're at least 40. It's really weird. You're at parties or whatever, and all of a sudden you go to some party in your mid-40s and you realize everybody's got reading glasses. It's just bizarre. So it just happens. What's happening is this thing becomes harder to deform. And you can only deform it so much and make it so strong. So you lose the ability to actually look at things that are much closer than you used to have. It's incredibly annoying, easily fixed with reading glasses, but it takes a little while to get used to it. And it's certainly a... You don't like being reminded of your mortality, I guess, in that way sometimes. But it's a lot better to be reminded in that way than, you know, other ways that can happen. So it's a minor thing. Other things that happen is, if you've ever heard of LASIK surgery, I should have brought a video, I had that. What they do in LASIK is they literally slit your cornea. It's a very narrow thing, so it's a very thin blade, and they suction right onto your eye, and they split it. I have a great video of it if you want to see it. And so, because I had it a few years ago, I went from being very nearsighted to having supervision. And so they slice your cornea, they take the flap and they lay it back, and then they use a laser to literally blast away the surface and reshape the surface that they've uncovered, wipe it off, put the flap back on, but in doing so they have changed the thickness in places of the cornea itself. And so they basically have the cornea become the corrective lens. Okay? And the nice thing about this is as you get older, you lose your near vision. And there's nothing we can do to stop that. I mean, maybe they'll have a way someday, but it will involve replacing your lens or whatever again. You'll lose your near vision. But as you get older, if your far vision will usually become stable. So you can correct your far vision using LASIK, and it's permanent fix, which is really nice. So if you ever consider having LASIK, the technology may change, but I'm going to tell you two things that if you ever do it, you'll be thankful I told you, or you'll never get it done. I'm not sure which. The thing they don't prepare you for when you're having LASIK done is that when they lay this flap back and they start blasting your cornea with the laser, you smell yourself burning. And that's a little bit skeeved out. You mean, that's a little bit strange. Just like, oh, that's not cool at all. The other thing is if you ever do it, if you've ever had a serious injury or surgery, okay? One of the things you'll note is, like at the end of the day, for weeks or months, when you get tired and everything, it'll ache and it'll swell a little bit where you had that injury. So when you do LASIK, the same things will happen. The next day's all fine. Late in the day, your eye might hurt a little bit. Things swell a little bit. So if you ever have LASIK, you want to do it about this time of year. Because what happens is when your cornea swells a little bit, it blurs out the light, and you get these beautiful rings around things. So it makes Christmas just faster. And I know this for a fact because I just happened to, not knowing this, I happened to have my surgery sort of, you know, early December, and it was really fabulous. So, I mean, you could totally sell drugs that do that. You know, get your Christmas visuals here. It's absolutely cool. So I highly recommend that if you need LASIK, that's when to do it. All right.
You can have all sorts of aberrations with lenses. I mentioned this one already, chromatic dispersion, which is the different wavelengths are bent differently. You can also have spherical aberration, which basically says if you have this lens, you can have a different focal length for the curvature here than you have in here. And apparently this is not so hard to get when you're making lenses. And so you can, again, get a distortion here. And there, yeah.
So what causes color deficiency?
Blindness. Color?
Yeah. Does that have to do with this at all? Or is that something in your eyes?
I think that has to do with retinas and eyes and brain. I don't know. Anybody know? Yeah, I think it's the retina structure.
I think it's not the nervous system.
Yeah, that's not an optics thing.
It's annoying.
Yeah, if it were an optics thing, it'd be easy to fix. You just, you know, give somebody the right color lens or whatever. Okay, so one of the things I have not talked about, which was sort of an omission earlier when we were talking about electromagnetic waves. When you think of light, you think of red to purple, right? But I can take my charges and I can wiggle them slowly or I can wiggle them really fast. So I can generate electromagnetic waves with a very broad range of frequencies, right? From 13.8 billion years for the frequency down to something enormously shorter than we can measure. Electromagnetic waves are fundamentally electromagnetic waves in classic character. And it doesn't matter how fast they wiggle. So there's this huge frequency range for electromagnetic waves, ranging at highest frequencies that we encounter, we just call them gamma rays. Then you have X-rays, are lower frequency, ultraviolet rays. And then you get this little region, very tiny little region of the electromagnetic spectrum that we call visible light. So that's near and dear to us, so we blow it up. And it runs from about 400 nanometers up to almost 800 nanometers, 750 nanometers or so. That's all you can see. And then as you go to longer wavelengths, longer wavelengths, you get infrared, radar, FM, TV, shortwave, AM, ultra high frequency, etc. So it's sort of pathetic, if you think about it. You really can only see a little bit of things. So in the classical world, sort of in our course, this all basically looks the same. All right? In practice, if you add the quantum mechanical to it, then we know that if we think about how light interacts in a quantum mechanical sense, E is equal to H nu. So light comes in quanta, and those quanta will depend on the frequency. So what that means is that the quanta of light over here, where the frequency is very high, have a lot more energy in them than the quanta of light over here. So that's one thing that really comes into play, and we'll talk a little bit about that. So you really do have to fret about what part of the spectrum you're in when you think about how the light is formed. You're sensitive to different things, different processes. If you're going to form gamma rays, you've got to have something that has very high energy to form them. And how the light passes through material, because how does it interact with the material? So the quantum mechanics becomes very important with that. You also have to think about the different wavelengths if you're going to think about classical optics and stuff like that. So we talked about diffraction. Diffraction becomes important when you're dealing with trying to image or pass through things where the size of the thing is on the order of the size of the wavelength. When you do that, your ability to image it becomes very difficult. it's impractical. So you can improve, for example, the resolution of an optical thing if you have a shorter wavelength, because effectively you're using a smaller wavelength, you'll have less diffraction as it passes through the same optical system. So there's a lot to that. We'll certainly talk more about diffraction if we have a chance, but let me talk for a moment about sort of what we see. This is basically your eye's sensitivity overlaid on the spectrum itself. So your eye typically is most sensitive in the green, okay? And you see things that are very purple, less well, and very red, less well. If we talk about quantum mechanics for just a moment and how light interacts with materials, the energy or the wavelength frequency becomes really important if you start talking about what's happening. So typically, you can think of the photons passing through the material and interacting here and there, and they'll interact in different ways. So this would be known as Rayleigh scattering, so that's sort of elastic scattering. So the light will elastically scatter, say, off an electron. So when I say elastic scattering, it means that the frequency of the light doesn't change, but its direction gets changed a little bit. You can have inelastic scattering, which is Compton scattering. So now the light scatters off an electron, sends the electron off, the frequency of the light changes a little bit. You have photoelectric effect, where the light basically is completely absorbed and the electron gets kicked out. Okay? As you go up in energy, you begin to have enough energy that when the light interacts in the electromagnetic field of a nucleus or so, it'll actually turn into an electron-positron pair, which we call pair production. And so as you go up to higher and higher energies, that's the primary way in which the light interacts with things. So what part of the electromagnetic spectrum you're in is really critical if you want to actually detect high-energy particles. So if you're going to be into astronomy or particle physics or some parts of medical imaging and things, you have to start worrying about what happens in these regions of the spectrum. And it's the quantum mechanics that's more important than the classical stuff usually. In order to think about how the world looks to you, you have to convolute your eye's sensitivity with the spectrum of what's being emitted. And so natural daylight has roughly this spectrum. Incandescent lamp looks like this. This is why often you think of an incandescent lamp as looking warm, because its spectrum tends to peak in the reddish region, which we sort of think of as warm. Fluorescent lamps tend to be a bit more blue. These days, if you go looking at lamps, you will see, you know, these bulbs you get these days. They'll often be cool or warm. They'll actually give you a temperature. And what they're sort of doing is giving you a measure of where the spectrum lies. So whether they look sort of bluish to you, and we call it cold, or reddish and warm. And I can't remember whether they actually give you a temperature. If they give you a temperature, then what they're probably doing is showing you the peak where you would be if it were a black body or something like that. So they can give you a different temperature range. But how you perceive it depends on how the light is emitted. There are lots of different eyes in the animal kingdom. Compound eyes are made up of, instead of imaging across a bunch of retinas, you have sort of individual things. So you have sort of individual elements that feed directly in. So that would be like the light of the eye of a dragonfly. One of the cool things is that the resolution of the eye has evolved to depend on what you actually need. So what you find, for example, is that as a beast becomes taller, then the resolution, your ability to distinguish between two things, becomes better and better. So humans
have pretty good resolution, because we have to be able to see whether we're going to step on something that's going to kill us, and we have to be able to see to reach down and pick up a grain of corn or whatever. As you go to other things like, I don't know, what's 12? A dragonfly or a bee, they're very small, so they get close to their food, so the resolution of their eye doesn't have to be so great. Falcon has, you know, the falcon is fairly short, small, but it has really great resolution to the eye because it wants to be able to see things from very high up. So I think that's sort of cool. Nocturnal things have the big eyeballs because they have to let in a lot of light. They have the big openings. This is like the coolest eye in the animal kingdom as far as I know. This is a minnow that has evolved to have an eye that looks like this, so that, you know, the index of refraction of water and air is different. So if you're going to image something in air, you need one curvature. If you can image it in water, you need a different curvature. And this crazy beast has an eye that can do both simultaneously. And so literally, it's quite happy to have its eye right at the water line. And it can see both under and above simultaneously. Is that cool or what? I was like, I feel completely jipped on it. It's a beautiful thing. Okay, so we talked a little bit earlier about magnification.
Yeah.
Going back in 3 slides to that chart.
Yeah.
One is humans. So why are there 2 boxes, and B, why is there like a jump discontinuity between those 2 boxes? Is there just like some humans have it great, but there's no middle ground? I don't understand.
I have no idea. Our friend Kirschfeld might actually explain it to us. And I think I may even have the reference at the start of it. Yeah, I don't remember. I may have known at some point when I stole this slide from someplace. Oh, that's probably Superman. Small box, because there's only one. I have no idea. That's certainly not the limit to which we can reach with instruments, so I don't know. I don't know. Okay, so for another way to think about magnification is to actually... look at the angle subtended. So, for example, if you have this object and you look at what happens with the rays of light, the image is out here, and that think of it this way, actually. So what you're doing is you're comparing the angle that this object would subtend if you had no lens to that which it subtends if you have a lens in place. And one thing that you'll have to run into when you deal with any of these problems is we say that the n for a normal eye, so that's called the near point. So the near point is as you move an object toward your eye, it's the point at which you can no longer focus to keep it in focus. Okay? And of course that's going to vary for you as a group. On average, it's 25 centimeters for humans with normal eyes. So that's the value that you use. Okay? You personally, it may vary. I didn't need reading glasses before I got LASIK because I would just take my glasses off and my near point was like here. But the minute I had my eyes corrected, I lost all my near vision. I'm having to start using reading glasses. So this height, if it's defined to be where you are at your near point, and then you compare the angle subtended here with the angle subtended when you put a lens in there, that can give you the magnification. So it's the near point over the focal length, or you can think about the angle. So a lot of the fun with lenses comes with what you can do with them besides working enhanced. And you can create telescopes. So for a telescope, you have a lens which brings rays in from we say coming from infinity because the object is generally very far away. And it will create an image at the focal length of the objective lens. And if you put that image just inside the focal length of this piece, which is what we call the eyepiece, then what's happening is this piece gives you a big magnification of that image. So you see this as the image, and then you use this as a magnifying glass so that what you perceive is something that's much bigger. So that's sort of how a general refracting telescope works. It turns out that in order to be able to do astronomy, you need lots of light, and you have relatively little light coming from very far objects. So that means it's a premium on having the collector of that light to be as large as possible. And it turns out to be expensive and hard to make really large objective lenses. So people don't typically do that for large telescopes. In fact, this is perhaps one of the largest ones. I don't know what the largest one in the world is, but this is probably close to it. It would have a 40-inch lens. What's typically done is you use curved mirrors. We're not going to do much with... I'll show you a few diagrams. We've sort of talked about how to do ray tracing and to calculate image and object distances and stuff with thin lenses. You can do the same thing with spherical mirrors. The diagrams look a little bit different. You have some conventions. It's really the same thing. If you can understand thin lenses and you're comfortable with that and you need to do something with a mirror, just go read the mirror chapter and you can do it just fine. It's not really any different once you're used to it. But the idea with mirrors is you create some mirror like this and then use it to act sort of as a lens to converge to an image here, and then you use an eyepiece to, again, magnify that image. And you can use different geometries. So this would be, I think, Schmidt-Cassegrain. This would be like a Newtonian type geometry for the telescope. It turns out you can make mirrors that are much, much bigger than you can make lenses. And so there are, as far as I know, the largest single mirror object is this DLT, which is about 8.2 meters across. What's typically done to get more light power, actually, is to make multiple mirrors and then use align them properly to basically collect them. And in fact, things have advanced to the point that you can use interferometric effects to combine the light from one telescope and another telescope to give you the equivalent of a much larger collecting power. So the Keck telescope, for example, has two large multi-mirror telescopes that are very, very far away. So the light collecting capability has come a long way in the last 30 years. The other thing that's happened is that, and here I'm on thin ice, I can't tell you the specifics, but you can, one of the big limitations with astronomy is that the light has to come through the atmosphere. If it comes through the atmosphere, it's coming through a region of space where you have different temperatures, so you have different indices of refraction that is just chaotically fluctuating. And what that means is that the light path gets bent in sort of chaotic fluctuating ways, and that dispersion, or that dispersion, and also that varying index refraction that every light ray sees relative to every other light ray, and how it varies in time, is going to limit your ability to make a clean image, especially one where you have to integrate a lot of light over a lot of time. So the way to really look at a distant object is to actually collect the light, right? So one of the things you can do is to
integrate over shorter and shorter periods of time. So if you're using CCDs or something, you can try to do that. So if you're using electronic, you can. If it's photographic film, you're stuck. You have to let the light hit the film for long periods of time. And for that image to be good, you have to have not only your device stable, but you have to, you're limited by how much that light gets bent by the atmosphere itself, the atmospheric distortion. So one of the things that people have been able to do is they can send a laser beam up and somehow look at that and then use it to tell them how to actually change the curvature of the mirror in real time to correct for distortions in the atmosphere. And they can take a lot of it out. So it's amazing technology that I really don't know anything about, so don't dare ask me anything. But I'll send you to Dan Watson or that group. They can tell you all about it, I'm sure. So if you get above the atmosphere, you know, the nice thing is you don't have that atmospheric distortion, which is why you get these really fabulous pictures out of the Hubble Space Telescope once they actually accounted for the fact that they ground the mirror with the wrong curvature. Microscopes, you look at the very small, it's sort of a similar sort of thing, except now you set it up so that your object is very close to the focal point here, you create an image, and then you magnify the image. So again, it's a sort of a similar optical system to the telescope. Cameras can be quite complex. You have multiple elements usually because you're trying to take out the distortions. You know, I showed you the spherical aberration you get when you have a standard lens. Often the focal point will depend on how far you are from the center point of the lens. And it turns out you can correct for that and chromatic dispersion and things by using all sorts of different shaped lenses. And with a camera, you also want to be able to move these lenses and get different zooms and things. So they're fairly complex beasts. Just to get a sense of some of the things that are relevant if you're into photography, there are a number of things at play. One of them is how powerful is your lens, focal length. The other is how much light do you let in, which basically is a measure of the diameter that you have here, okay, the hole size. And then the third is how long do you let that light integrate on the detector to give you an image that has the right brightness. So we talk about f-stop. So f-stop is the focal length, so that is a measure of the power of the lens, divided by d, which is a measure of the diameter of this diaphragm, so that's telling you how much light you let in. If you have a large f-stop, okay, so each f-stop represents a factor of 2 in the light intensity. So the faster the object or the darker the day, if it's darker, you need a slower speed, okay? If it's fast, then, I mean, if you're going to see it, you need a faster speed. But there's, what am I getting at? You get some effects that happen depending on how big this hole is. If you're looking at something that you're trying to image that's dim, you want a bigger hole. If you have a bigger hole, then it's going to have effects on your ability to resolve things on the so let's look. If you look at light coming from a lens, you'll get a region over which you can get a decent focus. And we call that region the aridis. And this is sort of called the depth of focus. So remember, you have objects from all different distances. So your ability. What am I really trying to do? So there's a region. If you think about the light coming from a lens, there's a region over where you'll get a good focus because of the diffraction. So as you go down to a smaller hole, you're going to have larger diffractive effects. But you can get some really fun things in photography. So let me just give you an example. And we're not going to worry about that camera, but I sort of wanted to just give you a sense of what happens. If you have a slow exposure time, that means your hole is very small. And if your hole is very small, you have a large depth of field because there's less diffractive effect, which means your ability to focus over things at large, many distances works pretty well. If you try to now make that very fast, and you do that by letting in more light, you now have a bigger hole, okay? And that's going to narrow the range over which you can actually focus things. So what that means is if you look out, you're going to have a very narrow window over which you focus things. So you can get some really cool photographic effects by varying these things. So for example, basically I took an SLR and took this picture, just one after the other of the same squirrel. But in this case, I have a small opening, that is, I made D very small, so I went to large F. And then here I made a narrow field. And look at what happens. Here you sort of have the background in focus, and here you blur it out. So there are lots of interesting photographic effects that you can use that are all tied together with how you use your lens and the opening and the timing, which is sort of fun. I'm out of time right now, so we'll come back to the other topics. It doesn't really matter as long as it's
successful. Okay,
sorry. There's also a